This is Brian Hunt, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee at the Bass Club reunion in Cardiff on the 12th of June 2010. Brian Hunt.
Well, my name is Brian Hunt, and I was born in Dartford in Kent in July 1930.
So you're nearly?
In about 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks' time, I'll be just passing the big 8-0, yes.
You don't look it.
Well, sometimes I feel it, but no, I don't think we do feel it, actually. Yeah. Myself and my wife.
Which means that your time in the Antarctic was quite early on, in the early 1950s.
I went down in October 1950 on the old John Briscoe, and as a FID. But then FIDs at that time also operated Port Stanley Met Office. So I did the first year in Port Stanley, and then I went down to Hope Bay.
What was your first, before all that happened, what was your first brush or connection with the Antarctic? Did you read about it?
Well, yes, I always read about it, but I hadn't really thought that I would want to go to the Antarctic. But the opportunity arose after I'd done my national service, and I was in the Met Office. And so I applied and got the job.
So why did you apply if you haven't got a lifelong hankering to go down south? Why did you apply?
Well, I think we were sort of outdoor types. I mean, I was an outdoor type. I wasn't a climber, but I was a walker and cyclist and wanted a sort of an outdoor life, really, rather than be cooped up in an office somewhere. In fact, my father wanted me to go into the bank. And so this is why I joined the Met Office earlier than expected. I'd got a choice between the Met Office and Ordnance Survey, which were both sort of outside jobs, which were the sort of jobs I wanted.
So you applied to FIDS, and I presume you had an interview of some sort?
I had an interview, yes.
Do you recall the interview?
I do, yes. I think it was Crown Agents then, wasn't it?
Was it?
I'm not sure. I think Vivian Fuchs was one of the interviewers. And anyway, mine was for a Port Stanley job. It wasn't for the Antarctic. It wasn't for a base job at that time. So,
what do you say was a rigorous interview?
I would think so, yes, yes. I mean, they really wanted to concentrate on whether you would be able to get on with another half a dozen people, I think. That was the main object of the interview, I'm sure. I was already a trained Met Observer, so that would cover me for the job that I was down to do. So I should imagine it was all, you know, the interview was all for things on the side. Your character, this sort of thing.
So they were looking beyond Stanley, do you think, the interviewer?
Well, I raised at the interview that I would like to go south, you know, rather than Stanley. And I think at the interview it said, well, you know, this job is Stanley, but you might be able to go south later on, which is what happened in the end.
Tell me about Stanley in 1950. What was it like as a place to live, first of all?
Well, I was working up at the Met Office, which was up on the top of the hill. That was, as I say, a FIDS job, and the boss there was Gordon Hawkins. Now, he was an ex-Antarctic chap on Tabarin, a Navy officer. Navy forecaster. There was a radiosonde station there as well. That was actually operated by the UK Met Office with a couple of local employees. And so it was a very nice office. It was a very interesting job because I think I said in some notes before that we were then forecasting for the whaling fleet. I mean, the whaling fleet was still going strong. And so it was forecasting for the whaling fleet. We also broadcast all the weather reports from the bases worldwide.
And by Morse, I presume?
Yes, well, that was through the radio station. We had a sort of a small radio station which was linked through to the government station in Stanley, which was only just across the field, really.
Was that the British whaling fleet you were talking about then?
Yes, it was. Now, was it not Sowers? It was the Southern Harvester and big ships like that. Because when I eventually went down to South Georgia, the whaling station was still going at Gritviken and Stromness, I think, and across the other side of the hill. And we went over to the whaling station. terrible stench. I mean, it must be. But it, once again, it was all very interesting. And in Stanley, it wasn't just the Met job that was interesting. I mean, I was there for over a year. And then after I came back from the base, I went back to work there for a while. I did a lot of walking. I learned to ride. So I visited all the camp, as it is called in Stanley. Made friends with several of the shepherds who lived out in the little houses. And in fact, lifelong friends. Because I used to go out to a place called Port Harriet. And they taught me to ride. Crook and Nelly, Middleton. They taught me to ride. They would send a horse into Stanley for me, or I would walk out. And I would go gathering with them. And in the end, I was called from the stations around other places, which got to know me from the walking. Sort of, we're gathering the sheep, or we're sort of gathering cattle or something next week. Can you come out? We'll send a couple of horses into Stanley for you. And so it was a marvellous life. But I say these lifelong friends, they were from Port Harriet, and everybody in the Falklands who emigrated had to come via UK. And I think they then used to get a boat from Tilbury. Well, my parents lived just over the river from Tilbury, so they became the Falkland Island Transit Hotel. And three families on their way to Australia and New Zealand actually stayed with my parents while I was still down in the Falklands or on the base. And those, I say, are the lifelong friends, because when we visited Australia, we met them out there, and there was another Antarctic connection there, because Crook Middleton, John Middleton from Port Harriet, when he went out to work, he worked for John Rymill of the Panola expedition at Panola Farm. And that's where my sister, when she decided with her family to emigrate to Australia, the whole thing went sort of full circle. John and Nellie Middleton looked after them and sponsored them when they arrived in Australia. So
give me a little thumbnail sketch of Stanley in 1950 when he first arrived. A sophisticated sort of place?
Not really. The sort of weekly dances, I think, were always attended. And I used to join in with all the things like the fishing. Used to go out with a little local fisherman. I used to go peat cutting and used to help out where I was in digs with the MacLeod family. He worked for the Falkland Island Company on the docks there, but he also had a peat business, peat cutting and peat delivering. And so I used to help out once again there. So learned how to cut peat as well.
You seem to get to know quite a few shepherds in the Falklands.
Oh, I did, yes. And I used to walk out, right out to Goose Green. Port Harriet was fairly close. I mean, that was only about 15 miles. But Bluff Cove of the Sir Galahad fame, I used to go out to the Bluff Cove house. And they would all, if I was walking along the hill range from Stanley, you know, past, if I was passing Bluff Cove, they would be very annoyed, because they would say, I've just seen a chap walking along, he's heading in your direction. And it was all these little wind-up telephones, you know, three rings for Bluff Cove and five rings for Port Harriet. And they would say, there's a walker heading your way, and, you know, make sure he calls in. And so I used to stay overnight at all the shepherds' houses and really enjoyed it.
We're jumping around. You went back a few years ago. Did you go to Stanley at that point as well?
Well, a few years ago, I was still with the Met Office, and there's a thing in the Met Office called the Mobile Met Unit. So if there's a spot of trouble anywhere, like the Falklands War or Iraq, or you just put your uniform on and go. And so I did about four tours up at the old airfield in Stanley, just at the very end of the war and through into 83, 84.
What were the significant changes you noticed?
Oh, masses of changes, yes. I mean, Whereas, I mean, a lot of refrigeration, television or videos. During my time there, the satellite phone came in, which made a terrific difference. Instead of just a monthly mail run or something, it was phone home to UK, no problem at all. But yes, I think the actual standard of living had gone up a lot. They hadn't got the big fishing revenue, which they've got now. I should imagine now it's even greater. But in those days, it was a simple life. You went out and dug your peat, and you went and sort of got some meat, or you went shooting and shot a few geese. But out on the camp, with John and Nellie Middleton out of Port Harriet, we would go out, and there it was a case of killing a bullock, say, for some meat, and the rest would go to the chickens. There was no way of keeping anything, because the Falkland Island Company, who had the store in Stanley, didn't want any meat to come into Stanley to be dished out amongst the local people. I used to bring in cream and such like from Port Harriet when I was walking. But I think all that had changed. Far more boats, I think, coming in. When I was there, it was still the tail end of the war, so the conditions for us were pretty poor. We lived out on the Alcantara in the harbour, the big ship Alcantara, and were transported into Stanley in landing craft each morning, and we did 24-hour shifts. So sometimes, of course, you'd then have to wade ashore if the tide was wrong. And so you'd start your 24-hour shift soaking wet. This was up at the old airfield. I think then it was possibly the most stressful forecasting that I've ever done.
Why was that? What, can you elaborate on that?
Well, yes, I can, because the information you were working on was very sparse. We had to pick up our own satellite images from the orbiting satellites coming over Stanley and the Antarctic.
So you're talking now about the 80s?
Yes, this is the 80s. I mean, we had none of that in the 50s, but this is the 80s. And there would be things like the... we were still officially, I think, at war, although there was no real activity. If the aircraft was coming from Ascension, the Hercules had to be refueled halfway. Would be very embarrassing if it had to divert into Argentina for any reason whatsoever. And you had to make a decision with the wing commander flying at the point of no return whether to bring the Hercules on to Stanley. You might have been in thick fog at the time. Whether it was going to clear in time for them to land. Mm. Because if they couldn't land, they were stuck. Mm. The same with the fighters. If they got a warning that there were aircraft approaching and they had to scramble the Phantoms. Harriers were all right. We had Harriers as well. I mean, they could come down vertically and come over the airfield and land anywhere. But the other aircraft, that was also very stressful. We've got to launch the fighters. They've only got a limited range, limited time. They've got to launch whatever the weather to go and possibly intercept. And then you've got to get them back. So you then launch a Hercules tanker. Are we going to get the tanker and the fighters back? And so it was very stressful, and one or two of our people felt it.
Did he volunteer? Did he volunteer to go back during the Falklands conflict, or were you sent?
Well, I was in the mobile wet unit, I was sent.
And the liaison between the Met Office then, who had the information, and the fighter command or whatever it was, who was giving the planes their instructions. Was that a close-knit liaison, or was it?
Yes. I mean, you were up at the airfield. I mean, it was just the old airfield. Mm. I mean, the Wing Commander flying was in the next building, and so he would come into the office, or he would be standing out there looking looking at the sky. He would then have to make the decision on what you told him.
But you knew that your information was critical, didn't you?
Oh, it was critical, yes. Yes.
So you were kind of making the decision for
it. It wasn't only the sort of safety of the aircraft. It was also that you would be a very unpopular fellow if you got the aircraft to turn round and go back to Ascension when there were 50 people in the Falklands who'd finished their tour and wanted to get on that Hercules to go home on leave. So
were you under pressure at times to... Was your judgment under pressure from time to time?
Yes. And I say this is why it was the most stressful period of forecasting that I'd done, because you were working on very limited information as well.
Was that overt pressure, or just pressure you imagined would be there? In other words, were you being told things to do, or were you fearful that if you made the wrong decision, you would get pressure afterwards?
Well, no, I think you knew the situation. You knew what would happen if you were wrong. Mm-hmm. And so I think the pressure was there, yes.
It was very real, was it?
Yes, oh yes. As I say, in 40 years of work, I would say that was the most stressful period back in the Falklands.
Do you remember how you coped with the stress? Were you having trouble sleeping? Or?
No, I was perfectly all right. No, I think after being down on the base, I came back, rejoined the Met Office. Actually, I worked for FIDS for a while in UK, because Dr. Pepper was writing a book on the weather of the Falkland Islands and dependencies. And so I went to Harrow, once again on secondment from the Met Office, to work with him writing this book. And that, then I went back to my ordinary job in the Met Office, and could have possibly stayed at one airfield or one office for the rest of my life. But I think because of the life in Stanley and the life on the base, I wanted something different. So that's why I did all these other things.
Mm. Okay, let's go back then. Thank you. That's fascinating. Thank you very much for talking about that. Let's go back now to the early 50s again. And you were Stanley for 1 year.
Yes.
And then did you apply to go south at the end of the year? Or?
No, I think it just sort of...
It came up.
It happened, really, that they knew I wanted to go south. They were opening a new base at Hope Bay. When I say a new base, the previous one had been burnt out 2 years before. And therefore, I suppose they knew... They wanted a senior Met man to go down and set the place up. So we built a hut up on the hill and lived in a temporary hut for while that was being built. And of course there was the little incident with the with the Argentinians, which is possibly off the record.
Other people have talked about it.
Yes.
So do you want to tell me?
Well, probably... possibly the only other chap you would have spoken to would be Alan Coley, was it? He was one of the people at Hope Bay.
I've not spoken to him, but other people have told me.
Yes. Well, we started on... we arrived at Hope Bay, and it was quite a shock to see that the Argentines had already built a hut. I mean, nobody knew this. They'd already built a hut. Their supply ship was in the harbour. Well, not in the harbour, it was in the bay. And, I mean, there was no harbour then. Mm. And Bill Johnston said, why is he anchored so far out? I can go in much closer than that. Bill Johnston, captain of the job. And, of course, he came straight in and ran us aground for 2 days. And then we started unloading the stores, and it was a case of everything into the scow, because there was no way you could get ashore. At that time, there was a small ice cliff at our landing point, And so we brought the scow in, started unloading stores up this cliff and getting them ready for sledging up, because we were going to build the base up on the top of the hill. And then the Argentine people came over. Argentine naval officer, I should imagine.
From their base or from the ship?
From their base.
Yeah.
And there were these chaps all in white suits, armed, yes. And I suppose they handed over the usual protest notes. And Frank Elliott, I think, was the chap in charge of us at the time. And this carried on for some time, and I suppose they must have said, if you do not leave, we will open fire. And they did. Because at that time, we didn't leave. We couldn't leave the stores there. And in the end, when it was decided we'd got to go back on the Biscoe and wait for the Navy to come, and we couldn't afford to lose any stores at all, so all those stores had to go back on the Biscoe again.
So just go back and paint a little picture of this scenario, if you from your mind's eye, of when the firing started. Where were the opposing forces, so to speak? Were you on the beach?
Yes, we were just up above the ice cliff. I mean, they were obviously firing over our heads or something. I mean, they because it was either that or they were very poor shots. But no, they had a Bren gun position right on the two graves. There are two graves of the two chaps who were lost in the fire. And they actually set a Bren gun up on the graves, which were only possibly 100 yards, 150 yards away from us. But then we eventually took all the stuff back to the Biscoe and waited for the Navy to come.
Well, they opened fire, and did your base leader...
Well, I think he decided then it was time for us to go.
Did he tell the Argentinians you were going to go?
Well, I don't know whether he actually... Okay. But I don't think there was all that much contact. I mean, no. It was... They said afterwards it was all a mistake, and that the officer, the Argentine officer, was exceeding his brief, as it were. And
at that time, it was all a case of gesture, really.
Yes,
it was obvious what you had to do.
Oh yes.
So you did go. You did start loading everything back onto the Biscoe.
Well, we had to, because we just couldn't afford to lose anything. Mm. Because I think they'd said, if you do not, you know, you've got to take all your stores back. This is otherwise, probably they would destroy them. I remember this cement fondue. It's in drums, quite heavy drums, but small drums. We'd hoiked all that up the ice cliff and then had to hoik it all the way down again to take back to the Biscoe. And I'd already handled all that stuff once in Port Stanley, because that was from the old Fenia, the storeship. Onto the Biscoe.
What were your feelings at that time? Do you remember what your predominant feeling was?
Well, I think the feeling was that it'll be sorted out in the end. We were a bit, obviously, disappointed at the time that we couldn't get ahead and start building the hut, because time was a big factor then. Mm. You've got to get the hut built before the winter. Mm.
So when the cavalry arrived, what shape and form did it take?
It was the frigate, one of the Bay-class frigates, the Burghead Bay. And that arrived with the governor on board. And at that time, I think there was still the Argentine transport ship in the harbour with one big gun. And the Navy people afterwards said, you know, they were a little bit apprehensive, because one shot from that... I mean, the Bay-class frigates aren't built for work in the ice. They've got a very thin skin. In fact, so thin that while they were anchored in the bay, and there was a bit of a hoolie blew up, they had to have sailors with long poles all around pushing the bergy bits away in case they actually pierced the hull. But certainly they weren't an ice-breaking vessel.
So opening fire was a bit of a risky strategy.
Well, they couldn't do anything. I mean, they couldn't do anything with the Argentine ship unless they started first, presumably. Mm. and one shot from them would have
from the old...
probably fixed the Berghead Bay. But anyway, it was a good thing that the Navy came in, because then all the Matelots came ashore and helped us haul the stores up to the top of the hill.
The Argies retired to their hut?
They retired to their hut. They had another couple of visits, I think, you know, from other ships. But it was after we'd built our hut, there was no further contact with those people, I would say, for about 3 months. I mean, there was their hut, a few hundred yards away. We'd built ours. And yet there was no contact. And this was silly, really. Until such, we were desperately short of seals for the dogs. The dogs were starving at that time. That was another completely different story. But we had to go and dispatch a seal which was right on their front doorstep. And they invited us in and said, "We're not the people who shot at you. They've all gone home. You know, we've got to live here for the next year. Let's be friends, more or less, then." And so from then onwards, there was a fortnightly dinner party alternating between the two huts, which was... they were just there as occupation. They weren't doing any scientific work or anything.
Was the dinner party competitive? Did you feel obliged to try and trump last fortnight's meal on the other base?
No. No, I don't think so.
No. Okay.
They had much better supplies of food than
beef,
we had.
Didn't they? Yes. Okay.
And they had a whole room full of spirits and wine and such like. Not our usually 2 bottles ration or whatever. Now, the business of the stores and the dogs, it was desperate, because once we got all the... we lived in this small hut, 20 by 10, 12 of us. So that was six bunks each side. Three and three and three and three. And a small paraffin cooker. And we lived in there for between 2 and 3 months, I would say, while we were building the main hut. So there was one amusing story, and that was, you can imagine, 2 or 3 months without a bath. I think we were all smelling a little bit. Jock Tate, Murdo Tate, who was one of the base people, built a bath, cut an oil drum down lengthwise, riveted the two pieces together and built a bath and set it up in the new hut. And so you obviously had a bath every 12 days if there were 12 of you in the hut, because you actually lit the little stove to heat your water, which was down the other end of the hut, and then it was your turn for the bath. Well, Jock Tate, big ceremonial, first in the bath, and he heated his water, got all stripped off, and of course the water was far too hot, he couldn't get in. So he said, could you get me some snow, you see, to cool it down a bit? And I think in the end we came in with great big ice blocks, and he was finished up in this bath with bergy bits floating around. And that was his first ceremonial bath, and also he finished up much dirtier, because he'd painted the inside of the... and the hot water had lifted the paint, and that stuck to him. And that was Murdo Tate. And he had the honour of... because he built the bath, he had the honour of having the first bath.
Was that bath something you, every 12 days, really looked forward to? Was it?
Oh, yes.
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 And washing clothes, was that also done in the bath?
Yeah, I mean, washing clothes as well. It was a case of, you know, you had your bath and you washed your clothes at the same time, because you'd got your ration of hot water then, you see. So you utilised the bath water, presumably, to wash your clothes. I think the following year, they actually got a washing machine down there. George Marsh got me to order through the Falkland Island Company in Stanley a washing machine.
We've missed out a bit about, before you went to Hope Bay, that there was a possibility at one point of you joining the transatlantic, transantarctic expedition?
Oh, yes, yes.
Were you actually invited?
Well, this was when I came back from Stanley, came back in 53. And then there was this coronation review of the fleet, which John Biscoe took part in.
Do you want to talk about that first?
Well, could do.
Yes, as is chronology.
Well, we came back on the old John Biscoe as well. And during the course of the trip, I think we were all measured up for uniforms. Those measurements were radioed to UK because the Biscoe was going to take part in the 1953, I think it was, review of the fleet, Spithead. And so we got back to Southampton, went and got picked up our uniforms, went home for a couple of days, then had to report back to the Biscoe to go out to Spithead, lined the decks, and then of course they took the uniforms back afterwards.
Was that an annual event or a one-off?
No, that was the one-off.
So this
it's whenever it was the coronation review of the fleet. Mm.
So this would be the famous commentary. Have you heard about this, where the commentator got drunk?
Oh, yes, yes. But whether it was that one or whether his was George VI, he may have been earlier than Queen Elizabeth, you see.
Yes, he may well have been. Yes.
May have been the 1937 one. Yeah. The fleet's all lit up.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Sorry, we are darting about a bit, but it doesn't matter too much.
Yeah, so you were saying, yes, when I came back, I was stationed. I did this job with Dr. Pepper and then went back to the Met Office. And I was at a place called Bovingdon in Hertfordshire and got a phone call from Vivian Fuchs and said, you know, a couple of months' notice, could you get packed up and join the Transantarctic Party, you see? It was, once again, one of those big decisions you'd got to make. But they'd already got the weatherman. The Met man was Hannes Lagrange, South African. Now, he would be the Met man for the crossing. Now, Vivian Fuchs was ringing me up to say to go down on the advance party with Ken Blakelock and others to set up their base. And there wouldn't be any guarantee that you'd get on the crossing at all. But if you did, it would be a case of, 2.5, 3 years away at least. And I'd only been married 3 months before. So I don't think there was, you know, really too big a decision to make. But then David Stratton, who was with me on the base, got on the phone, and George Marsh came on the phone. Well, they both went on the Transantarctic. David Stratton was deputy leader with Fuchs. And David said, come on, Brian, you must come. And but I couldn't really.
No.
I mean, married 3 months, possibly going away for another 3 years. But I had already passed my aircrew tests at Hornchurch, and I was due to go into the RAF in another 3 months' time. So, you know, I had a backup.
I mean, I know your dealings with the Transantarctic expedition were limited, but did you get the sense of it being a fairly professional setup, or was it a bit like FIDS at that time, a bit bumbly, a bit amateurish?
I read the book about the setting up the, you know, the first year when they lived in a crate, when they lost a lot of their stuff. Ken Blakelock, I spoke to, he was in charge there, and I read this book. Whether you can believe everything that's in it, I'm probably rather glad I wasn't there for that year, because there were lots of personality clashes, and they were let down pretty badly, I think, by the people back home.
Did you meet Fuchs?
Oh, yes.
More than once?
Yes, oh, yes.
What did you make of him?
Well, I would think he was... he'd got to get his own way all the time. Certainly. And I think this came through with the planning of the Transantarctic and the setting up of the original base and where it was set up and everything, which things just didn't work out very well. I mean, the crossing was all right in the end, I think, but I think that first year with Ken Blakelock would have been pretty harrowing. I mean, they lived in a packing crate, a snowcat packing crate. So there we are.
Let's go back to Hope Bay then, and we'd had this exchange with the Argentinians, and you were talking about there being a lack of food for the dogs and lack of other resources. And there was a strange, rather odd explanation as to why the base had been poorly supplied, wasn't there?
Yes, it was.
Well, the supplies are poor, I should say.
Now, this was Sec Fids at the time.
Johnny Green.
Well, there was Green and there was Frank Elliott. Mm. You always had 2 years' supplies when you went in case you couldn't be relieved the second year. We had 2 years' supplies minus what was on this piece of paper, a little plan, which was drawn, which said from that when the old base was burnt down and evacuated, there was X tons of anthracite, there were 50 seals, there were two boats, there were X tons of this and that, and there was all this food. And so therefore that was all deducted from our 2 year supplies because it was already there. But it was under about 20 feet of blue ice. And we were chipping out, you know, to actually, we still worked on our 2 years' supply. Mm. I was in charge of the food, and I had to issue the cook, the weekly cook, with his rations for the week. And so I just divided what we'd got by 2 years. And so that was the ration. But we did get other stuff out of the hut, eventually, out of the old store hut. We fed the dogs on tins of herring in tomatoes and things. We eventually found some stockfish, you know, the dried fish, which we were feeding the dogs on. We were feeding the dogs on meat and veg, canned meat and veg, which were army rations. Because in those days, a lot of FIDS clothing and supplies were ex-wartime stuff. And so therefore, we were short. We didn't have the boats, so we couldn't get any seals that drew up anywhere other than, you know, right on the beach there. And so we had to get every seal, and the dogs were literally starving. And so it would jeopardise the whole of the next year's surveying and all the sledging trips if the dogs were no good. So it was George Marsh, Ken Blakelock, David Stratton, and I think Bob Stoneley manhauled. They fitted themselves up as per Scott and manhauled over to Deuce Bay, killed as many seals as they could in Deuce Bay, manhauling around Deuce Bay, because at that time Deuce Bay was completely covered. Caught the Bay of 1,000 icebergs. And then they stockpiled them there, brought, manhauled back a certain amount of seal, fed up two teams of dogs, got them fit. And then we went over with those two teams of dogs to ferry all the seals back to feed the rest of the dogs. And it was, I mean, the dogs were using all our medical supplies. George was looking after the dogs and trying to save them. And it was a rough time, really. Purely and simply because you couldn't get that stuff. David Stratton eventually got the boats a year or 18 months later, because we had quite a melt the next year, just after I came out, and the boats were uncovered. But we were out there picking out pieces of anthracite with ice axes, you know, one piece at a time, out of the ice. And, of course, you were down 10, 15 feet or more, which you'd excavated to get to the stores. And then, of course, the first blizzard filled the lot up again. So, Yeah, it was quite a time, and I'm afraid Seckford's name was mud for a while.
Morale? Poor?
No. No, I would say the morale on the base was good. I mean, we'd got so much work to do. I think this was one of the other things. I mean, setting up a completely new base, building the hut, getting the dogs learning how to sledge. Ken Blakelock was the only sort of trained man there. And, I mean, I'd got my Met work to do. There was no, as far as I know, there was no friction on the base.
How many were there of you?
Well, there were 12 of us, right. Because it was a sledging base. I mean, 12 went there all the time, obviously. There was one, I mean, I can say it now. I don't think the chap would mind. Once again, it's possibly reflects on organisation of FIDS. We had 12 people. I had two other Met men with me. Alan Coley was one of them, and Brian Kemp. We had to take it in turns, obviously, keeping the 24-hour system going. If people went out sledging, you know, you were reduced in numbers. Also, Murdo Tate, who came in to the base, he wasn't due to be on the staff. He came from another base and joined us, and so he stayed for the year, and so he did some Met work. And at the end of the year, when I came out, I discovered that one other base member was, in fact, down there to do the Met work, but never let on. Said he was down there to do something else.
Okay, we'll leave that one hanging.
We'll leave that one hanging, but there was a person on the base who should have been taking his turn and didn't.
And the base leader hadn't known about
that?
The base
leader didn't know.
Oh, right.
I didn't know until I got out back into Stanley after the year. But there we are. During my first year in Stanley, of course, I learnt to radio operate to a certain extent. I wasn't very good on plain language, but certainly figures and such like, receiving weather broadcasts. So on the base, we had Peter King, who was, he's still around, he's in New Zealand or somewhere, and he was our wireless operator. But there was no way that he could get out sledging unless somebody else could take over.
Right, so you learned.
Well, I had my Morse key and everything set up next to his. So I did some of the operating with him, and it was... we had to get permission from Stanley for him to go sledging and for me to take over the radio operating just for a couple of weeks. And so I did that. And Pete, I've seen in things that he's written, said, you know, if it wasn't for Brian, he would never have got sledging, and he would have, you know, really regretted that. But the day he came back from the sledge trip, he took my key out of the radio room and said, "That's it, I won't be able to go sledging anymore. This is my radio room." And that was it.
How did you take to sledging?
Well, I only went, I only did all this hauling over to Deuce Bay and
right.
A bit south, you know, out to Eagle Island, and that was good. I was interested also with the differences of the weather. I mean, Hope Bay was had so many local effects that really I think in the end they dispensed with it as a weather station because it was so unrepresentative.
Was there an inkling of that when you were doing your Met observations, that the readings you were getting were atypical for the Antarctic?
Oh, yes, because you could see. I mean, the Argentine hut, as I say, was about 300 yards away. would be perhaps having a wind of about 80 knots. We'd be in flat calm. You could see the line across the bay where the wind came down from the glacier, which was the fornicator, as we called it, as opposed to the fernicator. The fern effect, which is you get in the Alps, where the wind flows over the Alps and you get a warming. So Hope Bay got not only the coldest temperatures, it also got the hottest temperatures in the Antarctic at that time.
I've not heard about... I've heard of the fornicator. Yes. I've not heard about the fernicator.
The fernicator, well, that's the fern wind. The wind only had to go round from, say, south to west. And then it came across the peninsula, descended on our side of the peninsula, and as air descends, it warms. And therefore, that's why we used to get temperatures over 50 Fahrenheit. If you got the fernicator. If you got the other one, it was minus 20 or something.
So it came as no surprise when Hope Bay was closed down?
I don't know if it was closed down. I don't think it was closed down because it was no longer representative as a... Right. I should imagine it was closed down because all the sledging and everything from there had been completed and done.
Yeah.
Because Ken Blakelock went back there and he did stuff on the outer-lying islands as well, over on Seymour Island and such like.
Now, I got a bit confused earlier. You went back to Hope Bay in 2003. Is that right, on the Larsen...
The Nordenskjold Larsen...
Centenary.
Yeah.
Veterans Expedition.
Yeah.
Want of a better phrase.
And my wife went with me. Oh. So she saw where all the letters went once or twice a year. We weren't married then, but she wrote the whole time.
Quite a few Finns who've done that would have been shocked by what they saw when they went back.
It was a shock. I mean, Hope Bay, of course, is a little Argentine settlement now. I mean, they've got a school and families and everything. But the old hut we went up to is still up there. But everything was bare. Where we used to have to sledge over the... To get to Deuce Bay or to get... start any sledging trip, you had to go up over the ice slope, and then when you came back you always had to let the dogs off at the top, otherwise they'd have hurtled down over the ice slope. That is just now bare rock. Where we hauled all the stores up to build our hut, we now see that is a deep valley going down. Oh, I said we had a sort of about a 15 foot ice cliff which we had to get the stores up over. Mm. Well, there's no ice on the beach at all. And when I spoke to somebody at the Antarctic Club dinner the other day, I said, who goes down regularly as a lecturer? I said, how's the snow and ice situation at Hope Bay now? And he just said, there isn't any. Mm. So it was... Well, it wasn't disappointing because it was good to go back to the old hut and... have a look round, and for Joyce to have a look as well.
What did she think?
Well, she was. She really enjoyed the trip because it was to revisit all the places associated with Larsen and Nordenskjold, because they lost their ship just the same as Shackleton did. But you don't hear about it. You probably do in Norway and Sweden, but you don't hear. They lost their ship. People were stranded ashore and had to be rescued the following year. But they built a little stone hut at Hope Bay. They built another little stone hut at Paulet Island. Mm. And they had already built their main hut at Snow Hill. So anybody who had been at those places, Hope Bay, or had been down through Snow Hill or onto the Larsen Ice Shelf, was invited to go on the trip if they wanted. And so that's how we actually went on the trip.
So you saw, I guess, what you came to the conclusion this was a side effect of climate change of some form or other.
Well, whether it's climate change or whether it's a natural cycle that, you don't really...
How do you feel about the theory?
I think it must be climate change now.
Induced by man?
Yes.
Right.
And sort of ozone holes, whatever it is as well. But, I mean, such a fantastic difference at a place like Hope Bay. When you consider how much ice has had to melt.
My next point was that the climate change work that was done 25 years ago, or was published 25 years ago, of course, would not have been possible without the readings you were taking 25 years before that.
Well, no, possibly not. But also, there's all the work with ice cores and things as well, which you're talking then in terms of years, hundreds of years and such like, which would reveal, you know, the long-term
patterns,
which we may be getting part of that pattern now. But, no, that wasn't really disappointing. But it meant that I couldn't really point out to Joyce, apart from the photographs that we've got, you know, what it was really like those years ago. The hut was still the same, well, virtually the same. The old cooker was still there. But, yeah. The winds, I mean, we were lucky when we went into Hope Bay. We had, on this trip, had good weather, and the Argentine chappy went and unlocked the hut for us because it had been used by the Chileans, I think. But there was nobody there when we actually visited. The winds, going back to some of the winds that we got, I don't know if you know, but we had no recording anemometer. We had to just watch the dials, as it were. And because we were expecting such strong winds, we had two dials, and they recorded half speed when you flick the switch. Because you're only it's a cup generator, you're only generating a current, you're measuring the current, converting it to a wind speed. And so if you then put the current through the two dials instead, you've got a half speed. And I've got a photograph at home which shows the two dials with the needle on just over 40 knots, which means that because it was a time exposure, it means that the mean speed was 80 knots. And then you were getting the gusts. And so we used to, it was often when you get a real fornicator going, the chaps would all come into the radio met room to look at the wind speeds, and then all of a sudden one day, God, oh, that was a gust, you know. And looked at the dials, they were both on zero. And I'd lost the anemometer tower. It had blown over. And we then spent, that was a 40-foot tower. And so out of the wreckage, we managed to build a 30-foot mast, 30-foot tower from the angle iron and such like. Mm. Then we had to remount that. And, of course, it was winter then. Mm. And we were out there day and night for about a week with hammers and chisels and bonfires to make the supports for the, to stop them freezing, of course, as well, with the old cement fondue, to build the new mast, which we did. You had to then apply corrections to the wind speed because it was a lower mast than 40. But then I was very pleased to hear that, very pleased, I suppose it was a bit rotten to think that the following year they came down with a brand new mast to install that. This was after I'd left. Mm. So they installed the brand new mast, the 40-foot mast, to replace the original one. Still left my botched-up 30-foot mast there. During the course of the next winter, their brand new 40-foot mast was blown down again, and my little 30-foot mast was still standing, and they had to use that as the the backup.
Well, they... I'm trying to get a picture of Hope Bay at that time. You've described the hut was as you say was quite a small hut, wasn't it?
No, the first hut was 20 by 10.
Yeah, and the one you built was bigger, was it?
Oh yes, that's quite a big hut.
So,
we had a sledging workshop and generator room and everything, you see. And one big room. It's in Fuchs' book, yeah. Of Ice and Men. There's a plan of the hut with our bunks around the room.
Was there any scope for privacy?
No, not unless you went off and had a wander somewhere.
Went outside.
Hmm. Yeah. No, there was no real privacy in the hut. I mean, you slept all around the room. Mm. The 12 of us had the 12 bunks around the main room. I would say that, once again, we all got on very well together. So,
I'm interested in this period you spent in the Pacific, which I guess was that before or after?
Yes, when I came, I said when I got this thing about the Transantarctic, I'd already passed my aircrew.
Yeah.
And I think that it all harks back to Stanley doing all sorts of jobs in Stanley and then doing all sorts of jobs on the base. A lot of them now I couldn't do. I mean, I couldn't splice a wire rope now, which I learnt to do there. I'm sure I couldn't do it now. But all those things made me want to do different jobs in the Met Office rather than being stuck in one job for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And so therefore I went on this flying job, which was based in Northern Ireland, and it was a weather squadron, and we did all the Atlantic weather flights, and we were Air Met observers, so we joined the RAF for 2.5 years, and I finished up doing 6, because I became Met leader, and then I instructed new people coming in, did other jobs. We had a Canberra to extend our vertical range of soundings, so I did most of the flying on the Canberra. Christmas Island for the 4 hydrogen bomb tests.
Well, tell me a bit about that, because were you there on purpose, or was it just coincidentally you were there?
No, it was, we had to do all the weather flights there.
Right.
And so instead of our squadron from Aldergrove didn't go out, there were Shackleton squadrons allocated for each set of bomb tests. Right. And so I was then detached to another Shackleton squadron. Actually, it still was a Northern Ireland squadron, but over at Ballykelly. And then we trained the crews there to do the weather flights. And then we went out in these adapted Shackletons through the States out to Christmas Island and did all the weather flights at Christmas Island.
So you were doing the weather flights prior to
the bombs.
The explosions taking place, right? So you knew what...
Yeah, well, there were 4 bombs, so, I mean, you were doing this all the time. You would do... And so, also you were doing... you were acting as search and rescue and everything as well.
How close did you get?
Too close, I reckon. Well, not... You hoped that the scientists knew what they were doing.
Only
but
hoped.
I think they were... I think the fact that they were out there testing them, you know, perhaps meant that they'd got to test them to see if they knew what they were doing. And when you look back... You think how stupid you were. You swam in the sea and they were dropping the bombs at a point which was less than 12 miles away. Therefore, you were then swimming in the water at Christmas Island. Mm. You were showering using salt water soap with the water straight from the sea. You were eating fish straight from the sea. When you went out, nearly all the time, you see, I was flying. So whenever a bomb was dropped, all the aircraft would go and take off. It would all be flying away, pointing away from the bomb because of eyesight. They took the children. There were some local children, native children. They took all those out to a naval ship and put them down below because they couldn't be trusted to look away. But for one bomb, I was actually on the beach when the aircraft took off, you went into landing craft in case it had a problem on takeoff. So you went into landing craft ready to scoot out to sea. You then came back and sat on the beach, and we had had to take our winter greatcoats to Christmas Island, which was one of the things we were told before we started. You've got to take all your heavy blue RAF greatcoat.
To protect you against radiation?
Protect you against the heat.
Oh, the heat. Right.
And then we all sat on the beach facing away from this thing, you see, and then you had the countdown. The bomb has now left the aircraft, or the device has left the aircraft, and then you got the countdown to the explosion. And you'd got your gloves on, you'd got several handkerchiefs wrapped together over your eyes, you got your greatcoat on with your collars up and everything. And then you got this terrific flash right the way through this, and then the heat on your back through the coat. And then after a certain time, you were told you can now turn round and look at the cloud, and then of course you got the old nice looking mushroom cloud, etc. Probably some of that might have to be crossed out. Yeah, but it isn't. Everybody knows now.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of people have actually become very ill or died.
I'm afraid most people... Well, not most people. I consider myself very lucky. Any mention of Christmas Island or the Falklands, when I was down with the mobile map unit, because I was a squadron leader then, has been deleted from my RAF records.
Really?
Because I do a lot of family history, and I do one day a week for a family history firm, and I was providing people with all their forces history as part of the job. Perhaps, you know, they said uncle or great-granddad was in the army or so-and-so. Mm-hmm. I would get his records. And so I thought, well, I haven't even got my own. So I wrote to Gloucester, Innsworth, to get my RAF records, and I've got them. But you can see where they've put a piece of paper over the overseas service. I've got no record, and I got in touch with them. They said, we have no record of you having any overseas service whatsoever. And this is in case you were claiming for subsequent illness or something, because the governments, successive governments, have denied that there was ever any.
And were you ill at all?
No. Not as far as I know. But
well, here you are, nearly 80, and looking very healthy.
But the, I think you had to be careful that if you did get any sort of signs or anything, you would have to, be doubly sure. My doctor knows about it. But when I went to get, when I went to join the mobile med unit, the RAF doctor wouldn't do my blood test to get, you know, where your blood test on a chain. He wouldn't do the blood test because of the Christmas Island thing. He said, no. He said, you'll have to get a civilian doctor to. The RAF would not want to give me a blood test, which was quite revealing.
At the time of these tests, clearly you had no choice about where you were. You were military personnel, so you had to sit there and take it. But was there any sense amongst you and your colleagues of any rebellion?
No. No, I mean, we were doing a job. Most of the time, as I say, I was flying. But you hear stories afterwards. I was down in the Falklands, and there was a navigator who had become an air traffic controller, and he used to sometimes give us a lift up to the airfield. And it transpired that he had been at Christmas Island the same time as me, and on Shackleton's as a navigator. And he was a different squadron. I mean, their squadron was going out as ours was coming in, or vice versa. Of his crew of about 10, And this was in 1983, so you were then only sort of 20-odd years after the bomb tests. There were only two left. Now, those are young, fit aircrew. I mean, that just the RAF, that was just one other job, you see, which you wouldn't normally do in the Met Office.
How do you rate your time in the Antarctic? Because most FIDs I come across seem to regard it as being the most remarkable part of their lives. Does it rate with you?
I don't know about being the most remarkable part, but it certainly would rate very, very highly. And it probably led me to do these other things like the aircrew. I then became a glider pilot. I specialised in forecasting for gliding. Once again, this was another little sideline job rather than the normal Met work. I then went on, I was the gliding forecaster for the British gliding team at the two World Championships in Poland and when we had it in UK. So I went with the British gliding team. Then I went up on the trawlers each winter. There was a trawler, we lost a couple of trawlers with icing. You know, they just capsized, lost the crews, I think. And then from that time onwards, they said that whenever the British trawler fleet was operating in Iceland, they would have to have a support vessel with a weather forecaster, a doctor, and a radar mechanic to service the fleet. And we had a little hospital on board sort of thing. And I went up there each winter. We were slung out of Iceland because of the Cod War. We then went over to Greenland the next winter, but it was too hazardous fishing off East Greenland. And then up into the Arctic, Bear Island and Spitsbergen for my last year. And so Joyce and I have been up to Spitsbergen as well, just to
the Arctic.
See that part of the world.
Okay, one last question then. Was there any time in your FID service that you feared for your life? Be it either with FIDs or in the Falklands during the conflict?
I don't think feared for my life, but
no. Near misses then, perhaps?
No, only near misses from probably being pretty nastily injured. We had a rope from the corner of the hut out to the weather screens because you had to clamber out there sometimes along the rope if it was really bad. And I think once I went out and I got blown away and I was just going faster and faster. I was airborne. And in the end, the only way I could stop myself was to try and throw myself down. And so I was hospitalised for a few days after that with George tending to me. But no, I don't think there was any time. And when you were sledging, there were obviously dangers. Mm. But I don't think you really thought about them. I don't think health and safety regulations came in at all. No, I don't think there were times in the RAF, you know, when we're flying over the Atlantic and you're at low level and you've got a couple of engines on fire. It's it was perhaps a bit dodgy then, but I never had to ditch. I never had to use a parachute.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. It's been great fun. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.